Hello, Amy.
Hi.
Hi.
Fun to put your faces and voices together. Thanks so much for being willing to do this, you guys. It's going to be super fun.
I was just thinking the same thing. Oh my goodness.
Amy, I can't believe this is the first time that we've like met. It's crazy. Hi.
Have you two never met in person before?
No, which is weird.
I'm a huge fan, but no, we've never met.
Likewise. And we've been like, I think we've emailed and we've had...
No.
I think both of our shows started around the same time. And so, yeah, there's like all kinds of intersections that I just kind of am in shock that it took this long.
And we're both named Amy.
We're both named.
That was really the connecting thread for this episode.
Yes. Absolutely.
we just seized on that.
Hey, welcome back. I'm Mendel.
And I'm Adam.
And this is Future Ecologies.
Kind of.
We've got a fun little format breaker for you today. We're sitting down with two of our favorite podcasters, Amy Westervelt of Drilled and Amy Martin of Threshold.
And we're going to talk to them about the thought processes behind the latest seasons of their respective shows. That's this episode, part one. In part two, exclusively for our amazing community of supporters.
At patreon.com/futureecologies.
That's where we'll get a little bit more inside baseball or inside podcasting. We're going to do a roundtable on the practice of journalism itself, and especially environmentally focused podcasting in these scary and chaotic times.
So please enjoy our conversation with two inimitable Amys.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us. We are both, it goes without saying, huge fans of both of your bodies of work.
Thank you.
Likewise.
And very inspired. So
thank you. Thanks for taking the chance of doing something a little bit out of the norm.
So you should both know, I mean, you've listened to our program before, I think, both of you. We do not do interviews like this pretty much ever live. So we are totally just like, hopefully this does not go totally off the rails, but we're going to try.
So... maybe we should just start it off with the classic. Who are you and what do you do?
Amy, please start.
this is going to be tricky.
Good one.
Amy Martin, why didn't you take us away?
So I'm Amy Martin, and I'm the founder and executive producer of the podcast Threshold. And we take one big topic every season and just do this in-depth, on the ground kind of thought and physical journey through that topic. So we've covered bison restoration in the US. We've covered our season four was timed to 1.5, about the time we have left until we hit 1.5 degrees Celsius of warming over pre-industrial levels. We just are in the midst of releasing Hark, which is all about sound and our relationship to listening and what it means, how we're changed by listening and not listening to our more than human planet mates. So big range of things, often kind of philosophical, environmental history, environmental justice, science, thoughts, feelings, all mushed together.
I'm Amy Westervelt. I'm a climate reporter, and I do a podcast called Drilled, which is sort of an investigative journalism podcast. We call it a true crime podcast about climate change because we look into sort of all of the people and things and ideas that are blocking climate action.
I want to ask you both, how did you get into journalism initially and into, I guess, you know, enviroclimate journalism?
Well, I grew up on a farm in eastern Iowa, and the only radio station I could get that wasn't like, you know, pop music was an NPR affiliate that we were just on the edge of. And when I got into college, I was kind of shocked to discover that the home of that NPR affiliate was housed at my college. And I was like, it felt like for a small town, like a rural Iowa kid, it sort of felt like, oh my gosh, I'm in the presence of, you know, superstars. So I begged them to let me work there, and they were shocked that somebody wanted to work there, I think. So I learned how to do reporting just on the job with them. They weren't like part of the college. They just were housed there, and it was such a great, you know, on the ground, like within weeks, I was out covering stuff. So in a way, that was my entry into journalism. don't worry, I'm not going to tell you my entire life story from that time until now, but I'll just say it was a long and winding path. And then about 9 years ago, I just really felt the urge to be doing more long form storytelling and really wanted to try to figure out how to tell stories that were about this thing we call the environment. And those are air quotes for people who can't see, from a different mindset than it's often repeated, at least in Western mainstream culture, where it just is assumption. And I think this is becoming much, much more common now, but just from the assumption that we are the environment is us. There is no such thing as nature and humans. It's all one thing. And also from within that undivided framework, trying to look for other ways to tell stories that questioned or broke down some of the traditional stereotypical ways of telling environmental stories and opened us up to maybe hear across divides while also recognizing the very real fact of those divides and their impact on people's lives and landscapes. So yeah, I just kind of dove in with like zero funding and zero support and was like, let's try to make this work. And so far it is. But it has been a wild ride.
I think I remember, was it your first season that was the buffalo story?
Yeah.
I loved that. I thought it was so good and such a good way of doing this, like listening to everyone in a way that's not doing false equivalence, which I think a lot of people don't know how to do. It was very good.
Oh, thanks, Amy. I mean, your first season was just such a sensation and has had such an impact. I'd love to hear you talk about your story into it as well.
Well, I was a print reporter for a while. I mean, okay, my way into journalism and every job I've ever had in journalism was like needing to pay rent. I was like, I had to find a job the day after I graduated from, you know, university. And like, I happened to apply for a job at a magazine that could have only existed in like .com era Silicon Valley days. It was a print magazine about online shopping.
How could this go wrong? It's like
such a bad idea on every level. But I was like, I had never considered even like working in media, and I loved it. I was like, this is great. I get to talk to all these people about shopping. No, other things too. But like, I get to talk to all these people and, you know, learn about things and whatever. And so then I sort of like went on from there and worked at various places, but I didn't start on environmental journalism until I once again was in need of a paycheck. I like went and worked for an arts magazine in San Francisco that had one of these like stereotypical publishers in charge of it, who was just a maniac and used to ask me to type his emails for him every day, like all day. So I had gotten into this schedule where I'd get to work at like 5 a.m. just so that I could actually get enough work in before he arrived and started dictating emails to me. And they were always like mad emails to people, including our mail lady, who he was in a constant war with. And so he would like pace behind me, you know, dictating these angry emails. And like one day I'd had enough and sort of quit in very like traumatic and spectacular fashion. And then the next day it was like, oh no, I have to pay rent in 2 weeks. So a friend of mine worked for a civil engineering firm, and he was like, well, we need someone to write up case studies for us, and it's like very, very boring work, but they'll pay you like as soon as you end each one, and they pay well and it's fast and whatever. I was like, great, thank you, sign me up. And the first one I did was on a project that they had done for Shell in the 90s to help re-engineer their oil platforms for sea level rise. And I was like, oh, that's interesting, because I knew enough about, you know, climate and environment and whatnot to wonder like, wait, was Shell even acknowledging that climate change was going to be an issue for them at this point and whatnot? And I looked into it and they really hadn't been. So I pitched it as a story, like as a freelancer to an environmental publication, and kind of like got obsessed with that whole story from that point onward. I ended up working for that environmental magazine. And then like, fast forward many years, I was driving around listening to NPR and feeling like FOMO, you know, like it's like, I wish I could be a radio reporter. And I thought, well, there's probably maybe there's a member station nearby that I could like intern at or something. So I emailed them, subject line, would you like an overaged intern? And they were like, they were like, actually, you know, like usually by this point I had worked for The Guardian and I'd been a stringer for a bunch of places and all these things. And they were like, you know, it takes us a lot longer to train people to do reporting than to train people, you know, how to use audio equipment and how to start thinking about writing for audio and things like that. So like, sure, come on in. So I interned for a month and then I got a job as just a community reporter for that station, which was in Reno, Nevada, a very odd place to be a community reporter. And that was like around the time that Serial and all that was going on. And I was like really thinking about what would be like a story that could work for a narrative climate podcast, and actually really struggling. Then I got assigned to do a story on litigation, climate litigation. And there was a case in San Francisco where the judge asked for a climate science tutorial, and everyone was calling it the Scopes Monkey Trial of climate because he wanted people to like provide testimony on like who had known what and when and what had happened with this information and all of that stuff. So I went to cover it, and I got there really early so I could get a seat in the courthouse. And I was like, oh, this is it. I'm going to do a true crime podcast about climate change, and we're going to do it like a courtroom drama. Cause there were all these, you know, like oil company lawyers, and the judge was very eccentric, and all the scientists had shown up, and there were like people with their Exxon new t-shirts on, like protesting out in front. And yeah, I was like, okay, this is great. And then like I pitched it everywhere, and everyone told me there was no audience for narrative climate shows. And I was just like convinced that it was a good idea. So I made it. Like it was me and my friend who's an audio engineer. The first season was like in my car at night, and we just put it out ourselves. And like, yeah, I feel like I was right and those guys were wrong. And definitely. I've just been, yeah, I was only ever going to do that one season. But then, you know, now we're launching season 14 tomorrow.
Hey.
Amazing.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. Sorry, that was a very long-winded answer.
Oh, it's fabulous.
Paying the rent, kids.
For real.
Inspiring people since forever.
I mean, it's probably a crazy thing for people to hear that you got into journalism because you wanted to pay the rent.
Yeah, I know.
Unimaginable.
I know. It's true.
Yeah.
It's true.
And environmental journalism in particular, I was like, oh, wow.
It's true.
How things have changed. So Mendel and I are going to tag team a few questions about each of your latest seasons here. You want to start, Mendel?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it should be pretty obvious that like Hark is a perfect synthesis of our interests, right? We're talking the natural world, we're talking science, and we're talking sound specifically. You know, we got to learn some pretty amazing things about all sorts of different creatures and the way that they communicate, and really cutting edge science about what we only most recently understand about how the sonic landscape functions. But it's also a really interesting new direction for your show. And we were curious about like, why go from climate reporting to this topic of sound?
To be honest, I think that this season has been in my mind the longest of anything. Like I actually started to pitch this as a book before I started Threshold. And I was in the middle of working on trying to figure out how to do a proposal for a nonfiction book. And I was like, this can't be a book. I need to bring people into these sounds, you know? But I started Threshold not with like, oh, I'm going to start Threshold so I can do a season about that. But it was like, you know, there was like an idea thread that went that direction. And then there was starting Threshold. But from the beginning, I kind of had it back there. Like someday I think I want to do, but you know, Threshold has never been in my mind a climate podcast. It's a show about our relationship with all the life around us and all the different gifts and perils and everything that we're in relation to our ecological situation. So I don't know. I do not have, I never have a good logical reason for why I did a particular season at a particular time. It's instinct and intuition. It's a combination of my own needs, honestly. I think after doing, you know, each of our seasons, Amy, you're such an overachiever. I feel, I feel insecure in your company, like 14 seasons in the same time we put out five.
Stupid amount of, it's like just, I have a, I don't know. It's a weird, I have a problem.
But I, you know, I think after immersing myself in, I don't know, when, was it a year and a half, 2 years of climate reporting and going to the COP conference and trying to trace the origin of like, when can, how, you know, when did we start burning coal and how did it get us to where we are? All this kind of stuff. That last season before this one was really focused on humans and things that we have done and are doing and our struggles to figure out how to move forward together. And all of that is obviously super interesting to me and super important. But I was just aware the whole time of like, there are so many voices that are just really hard to integrate into this story, non-human voices. And I was just really ready to turn my ear and attention to them. And I think also on a subtler level, I am just increasingly convinced that this is part of what we need to do to figure things out. I mean, just to make that concrete, when I went to the COP conference in Glasgow, which was mind-blowing, I learned so much, but you spend 2 weeks basically inside like an airport, like you're in this sealed environment, you go in through security, there are literally like tubes connecting the different parts of the conference that look like, you know, hazmat areas. Like it's just basically everything is kept out but humans. And I understand like they're trying to run a conference and they have to have high security and all this. But on like an animal level, I'm like, everything we're talking about matters to everything else that is getting pushed out of this space. And I'm not so much trying to harp on the COP conference, it's just say that this happens all over and over, you know, the halls of Congress, the parliaments in different countries. It's just like, we're making all these decisions, we're bandying about these ideas, we're, you know, struggling through these problems, and it's all so species-centric. And I know there's a danger of some hokiness here of like, let's let the birds tell us what to do. And that's not what I mean. But I do really believe.
That would be okay.
Like, yeah, actually, they probably have that. Some great ideas. But I do really believe that taking, understanding ourselves to be one form of life in this gigantic mixture that has an incredible amount of power and not anywhere near enough wisdom to manage that power is an important starting place for figuring out any of these problems. And part of how we can like find some more humility in these conversations is to just shut up and listen to the rest of the world. So I felt very self-conscious, honestly. I was like, I'm going to ask people to listen to episode after episode in which human drama is not at the center. And I don't know if people will hang with that. Like our brains are wired for like, give me a hero, give me a villain, put me in a conflict. What are we, you know, I was like, this isn't going to be like that. But I have absolutely loved making it. And, you know, I've cried over making it. It's not all like sunshine and roses. I've also just been totally delighted. I've learned so much and I'm proud of it. I feel good about it. Whether or not it actually changes anything, it has changed me in really positive ways.
Oh my God. I think we're going to come back to that because we want to ask you a question about that as well. But I would say that was our response too, like delight, some grief, some pathos, and also just fascination, right? That it brought us places that we hadn't been before and brought us some joy. So it worked, I think, on all of those levels.
Also, I feel like I won't project onto everyone, but I am definitely like tired of hearing humans talk about this. So it was nice. It was a nice break.
A bunch of podcasters tired of hearing human voices.
It's an occupational hazard.
That's our conversation today, folks.
Oh, the irony.
So,
yeah.
I've got a variation on the question Mendel asked for you, Amy, which is your most recent seasons drill down on setbacks within the environmental movement, slapped, takes us back to Standing Rock.
Yeah.
And Carbon Bros takes us into the manosphere.
The manosphere.
Why on earth did you decide that at this moment it's a good time to transport us to these places? Why did you decide to tell these stories now?
Well, let's see. The slapped one. So that one is about the energy transfer lawsuit against Greenpeace. The thing that was interesting about that lawsuit to me was not just that it has this huge potential to impact kind of everyone working on climate, because just in as shortly as I can, the pipeline company that built the Dakota Access Pipeline, which is the pipeline that was at the center of the Standing Rock protests in 2016-2017, initially tried to file a racketeering case against Greenpeace and several other entities. That failed, so they refiled a very similar case in state court in North Dakota. That just went to trial in February and then resulted in a wild ruling where the court has said that Greenpeace, well, three Greenpeace entities owe Energy Transfer $660 million in damages for the impacts of those protests. So obviously there are a lot of free speech implications there, but also I found it like an interesting illustration of why like narrative framing is important. They really like the mission there for the pipeline company was to totally like reframe the story of Standing Rock from something that had inspired, you know, solidarity with Indigenous sovereignty that we haven't seen in a really long time, you know, inspired a ton of climate action, famously inspired AOC to run, you know, run for office, and like was a lot of the inspiration behind the Green New Deal. Like it inspired a lot of climate action and was 100% an Indigenous fight that then various other people showed up, you know, kind of in allyship with. They wanted to reframe it as this actually the story is that this radical fringe group Greenpeace came in and like did all this stuff. And, you know, the Indigenous activists were just pawns in their game and, you know, all of this stuff. So it's like offensive on a couple levels while also being very damaging to free speech. So anyway, it felt like an important story to tell now as we're seeing what's happening with the second Trump administration in the U.S. and globally, a real crackdown on protest, which in a lot of ways was, at least like this most recent part, was fueled in a lot of ways by a backlash to that protest. So it felt timely. We also, the lead reporter on that, Aline Brown, has been covering Standing Rock since 2016. And because of that, is so deeply sourced in the Indigenous community there and within different activist networks as well, and has access to so much documentation and all of that stuff. And then also, no one was sending reporters to that trial. I think there were a few outlets that sent people for day one and that covered the verdict. But the only other reporter who was in the courtroom every day was from a local North Dakota outlet, which is great. But because the court wasn't allowing, they didn't allow any recording or streaming or anything. So having someone there to document that case actually turned out to be very important.
Yeah, that's crazy. I learned about it from you guys.
Yeah, like there really was hardly, I mean, understandable because there's just so much going on in the world, but there was hardly any coverage of it. And it was a big deal. So yeah, Carbon Bros. Yeah, I just like, someone mentioned this to me a few months ago that they were like, oh, you know, the manosphere is really talking about climate a lot more. And I was like, what is the manosphere? And they were like, oh, let me tell you. And then I was like, this is really interesting. And I feel like we can do it in a way that is like kind of lighthearted as much as you can be about such things. And just showing how these things intersect and like why it's important. I don't know. I'm a little bit obsessed with like climate as a symptom of all these other big structural problems. So, you know, that's one of them, figuring out like how we define masculinity separate from extractivism and domination and all of these things, I think is like a pretty important part of figuring out tackling the climate crisis. So So yeah. And then actually drilled down, that's a bonus episode, not a season. It's just a, I have this reporter who is a voracious reader and was like, I really want to do book reviews and author Q&As. Would you guys be interested? And I was like, yes, actually people always pitch me on this and I've always thought it would be cool to do and I don't have the time. So like, please go forth. So he's started to do that. That's Adam Lowenstein. The big answer to the question is that I have been enjoying this past year, like kind of taking a back seat and letting some other reporters drive with their ideas. And then I just am like supporting and keeping all the trains on time. And like, obviously joining in too. I have a lot of opinions. But yeah, it's been fun. It's fun to like help other people make their stories.
It's so amazing to see not just what you put out in the world, but what you've created for other storytellers. Back over to Hark, you put out a really amazing host statement to sort of introduce and contain the series. And in it, you write, how can we hope to solve anything? And this connects to what you were just saying, Amy, climate, biodiversity loss, profligate waste and pollution. If we wander around in an echo chamber, hearing only our increasingly agitated voices. And you gave some examples a second ago, I think, of the sort of conditions where you see that echo chamber. But I'm wondering if you have some examples of the opposite, if you've seen ways in which listening to the more than human world has changed us for the better, has changed you for the better, perhaps.
Well, the very first image that comes to mind is from several years ago, many years ago. So I had a whole stint in my professional life where I was an independent singer-songwriter. And as part of that, I also started some community music programs because I got so sick of people telling me that they couldn't sing and couldn't make music. And I was like, yes, you can. So they were for all ages, but one of the groups was a kids group. This was here in Montana, and we really integrated a lot of our gorgeous natural surroundings into our music making. And I was outside with a bunch of kids one day, and we were working on a song just like under a tree. And I was just like, let's just be quiet. Let's just, everybody just like find a spot, you know, where you're not going to be banging into somebody else. Close your eyes and just listen. And I think we were just like in a city park. It wasn't like we were deep in the wilderness or something. And watching, you know, 25 kids ages like 8 to 11 lay there and listen. I think I set my timer for like 5 minutes and I was doing it too. And then we just kind of emerged and came together and made our little circle. And I'm like, what did you hear? And everybody's just like, you know, I heard this dog. Did you guys hear that bird? Did you hear that? You know, and the excitement and also just the calm that we suddenly were sharing together. It's a simple example, and it's obviously not people that are out, you know, making climate policy, but yet, although maybe they are now. That's just the first thing that flashed into my mind of, it's so available to us at any moment. And you don't have to be in some pristine, you know, wilderness to just calm down for a second and take in what's outside of you. And I think there is something inherently relieving about that. I know there is for me. I mean, to answer your question about myself, just yesterday, my friend and I were on a hike together and we were talking away. We haven't seen each other in a while. And it was just like, you know, which was really fun and needed. But at a certain point, I was like, let's just be quiet for a second. And I ended up actually writing a little essay about it this morning, just what flowed from that. Just sharing a little bit of silence, we ended up hearing this amazing, most ravens I've ever seen all together happen to fly over our heads, croaking away as we were sitting there. Probably wouldn't have noticed them if we had continued our conversation. And there's a way that it had to like break our flow for a minute in order to open up to this other kind of flow in conversation. I think the effect it has on me is to place my personal story and all of my troubles and all of my worries and fears and hopes and all of my internal machinations of the for the future, it just places them suddenly in this landscape of other conversations, some of which, you know, we're in the mountains, so some of the conversations that are happening in the landscape are millions of years old. And then there's these ravens having a party together, like in a high alpine. Why? I don't know, but they were having a great time talking away. To see myself in my own story and hear my own story, it's not erased. It's not gone. It's just like, it's actually really tiny. And it's also part of something. And I think both of those things, the smallness of my story and the fact that it is part of these larger stories, it's meaningful, it's relieving, it shifts my whole mindset as we continue our walk and talk about the murder of Charlie Kirk and what the aftermath is going to bring and what's happening in Gaza and what's happening in Ukraine and, you know, how she's thinking about social media for her 8-year-old daughter and, you know, all these different things that are just, of course, like that's what we're all worried about. We're all talking about money and health and all these things, but it just sets it into an actual physical landscape and an emotional psychic landscape that has more space and has more room for me to understand myself as kind of like just as an animal that's just trying to get by like all the other animals. Mm-hmm. I'm not really sure if I'm answering your question.
Oh, no, I think an animal reminder is a useful prescription for everybody. And like you say, that it's not necessarily about privileged access to quote unquote wild spaces, that we can find that mode of attention anywhere, anytime, if we make the space for it.
Absolutely. And if I can just expand on that a second more, one of the most interesting sets of interviews I had for HARC was I went to Richmond, California to a youth center there and talked to a whole bunch of kids. I wish I could put every single one of them in the show. But I just talked to them and like, when you think about like listening in your neighborhood, like what comes up? And there was just, you know, a huge range of things from the sounds of birds to the sounds of gunshots and people talking about, you know, being frustrated because the train is so loud and it's coming by their apartment every 20 minutes all day long. And two kids talking about, you know, the sounds of family and neighborhood parties and making food together. And again, it was just like asking the question of what are you listening to and what does it mean to you to listen? It kind of just opened up into all this thoughtfulness with them of connection and interruptions of connection. You know, getting to go for a walk in the Montana mountains is absolutely a privilege. And most people don't have access to that. And there's only a limited amount of time when all of us have like the physical capacity for that. But we all can open up a window or walk out the door or roll out our door and listen, including people who don't hear airborne sound or don't hear airborne sound very well. I had a fascinating interview with a woman who's just an amazing percussionist who is deaf and is like one of the best well-known listeners in the world, you know? So it's like, it's there for all of us. And I think it's mostly about like a shift of perspective.
I was also really touched by those conversations with those kids in Richmond. I spent a lot of my younger years at my grandfather's house in Walnut Creek, just nearby there, just east of the hills. And Bart, the train you're talking about, I assume there's not that many trains
it's
in the
loud.
Area.
Yeah.
It's so loud. It's so screechy.
It goes right through my grandfather's backyard to the point, actually, that their neighbor is a train enthusiast. Like he moved there specifically because he loves trains. Okay. But Walnut Creek itself actually used to flow through my grandfather's backyard when he bought that house. And they moved Walnut Creek to build BART in that area.
Wow.
And so I'm just imagining the difference in that soundscape. You know, when I think about my childhood, like experiencing that creek as basically just like a little trickle in a concrete channel with barbed wire around it, you know, kind of next to the train tracks versus what that would have been. Anyway.
Yeah.
But that just brought me right back there, those conversations.
Mm. I had a whole little scene of myself on BART listening to, and to be honest, I love BART. I always take BART when I'm in the Bay Area, but it's also hilarious to me and disturbing. And it's not just BART, but to sit on any of these like, you know, major metropolitan area subways and everyone's, you know, staring at their phone, acting like nothing is happening. Well, the machine around us is literally making sounds that would be great in a horror film, you know, just like these, like screaming, screeching, ear splitting. And we're all just like, nothing happening here. But I decided to take that out of the podcast. It felt like I was dissing on BART too much. But
Yeah. Not to make any negative comments about BART. BART is great.
But it's loud.
It is loud. It is very loud in your backyard 20 minutes every day. You're right. Mm-hmm. Speaking of connections. So Amy Westervelt, this is killing me. It took me a minute to kind of, I was like, these are interesting stories to be telling right now at this moment, you know, hence our previous question. And it took me, you know, partway through the series to be like, oh my God, like this story about Greenpeace and this slap suit is so much kind of an antecedent to what the Trump administration is doing to all sorts of major institutions in the country, right? In terms of like this shakedown, the slap process is sort of paving the way for that kind of politics. And so that I was like, oh my God. I mean, I know you guys underline that. So it's not like I just made that connection.
We tried not to push it, you know, we tried to be like, see?
Anyway, yeah. Message received. And similarly with, you know, with Carbon Bros, I was like, oh, the fossil fuel industry is funding a lot of this anti-trans discourse.
Yeah.
And that kind of blew my mind. Like, I did not realize that that was happening. And that is such a crazy thing, but it tells you a lot about where we're at. So I'm just wondering, like, what did you hope people would take away from these series? Did I get the message? Like, what are you hoping people learn from this?
I mean, it's funny because, like, yes, of course, we want to make people aware of these things. But I think actually in both of those situations, what I want people to take away is like the importance of solidarity and community in both of those. Like in the Slapped season, we get into the fact that Energy Transfer offered Greenpeace a settlement. And the price for that settlement was basically throwing the tribe under the bus and saying, oh, actually, we were wrong and the pipeline didn't destroy sacred sites, which it absolutely did, by the way. Like, even in that hearing, you know, Energy Transfer's own experts said, well, I'm an archaeologist, so I can say whether there were archaeologically significant things in the pathway of that pipeline, but I am not qualified to say whether there were sites that were sacred to the Standing Rock Sioux tribe in the pathway of that pipeline. Only the Standing Rock Sioux tribe can say that. And the Standing Rock Sioux tribe has always maintained that there were sacred sites in the pathway of that pipeline that were in fact destroyed. So for Greenpeace to come out and say, no, there wasn't, would have really been quite a big line in the sand, let's say.
Betrayal.
A huge betrayal. And yet there were factions within Greenpeace who were considering it. And I think there's a real parallel there to what we're seeing with institutions in the US right now, where you can see that there's this like, well, but if we just concede on this, then we live to fight another day. And if we, you know, like, okay, it's bad, but like we can repair that relationship. But if Greenpeace goes away, then, you know, it just goes away and that's it. So like we got into quite a bit of detail about their thinking process on that, because ultimately they netted out on the side of like, no, it's actually more important for us to show solidarity, even if it's an extinction event for us, even if it means that like Greenpeace US goes away. Our mission is not to exist as a nonprofit. Our mission is to, you know, push like the world towards acting on these issues. So like we can't like sacrifice this relationship for the sake of our own financial stability or whatever. And I really was like, you know, that is a high price to pay for solidarity and 100% worth it. Because what has happened is that, A, in this weird way, I almost feel like it made Greenpeace like more relevant and more respected within the climate space, you know, and certainly within Indigenous spaces. Like, you know, Greenpeace had a fraught history with Indigenous people throughout like much of its early history. So like for them to show up in this kind of a way was like a nice kind of end cap on that history. And like, no, like this is what we're doing. But it was interesting because like we talked to this one board member who comes from an activist background, and she said, you know, it's only been fairly recently that environmental activism is something that like you could do as a job. And what has come along with that is, you know, larger and larger organizations. And when you end up with a big organization, there are going to be people in that organization who come from an activist space, and there are going to be people who come from a business management space. And like, you need both those people, but like for these like kind of big value decisions, it's like, all right, which way are we going to go? Are we going to be activists or are we going to be bureaucrats? To me, I see a lesson in there for, you know, Harvard and Columbia and all of these universities that have been kind of caving in. Media outlets too, like the whole 60 Minutes thing and all of that. I'm just like, I understand there's this huge financial threat, but I do feel like showing people what it looks like to actually like live in integrity is important right now.
Totally. Yeah, live to fight another day is like, what day?
Exactly. Why? That day doesn't matter if it's like in that way, you know?
Today is the day.
Today is the day. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And similarly with the Carbon Bros thing, I think, you know, the point is not, look at these terrible men, how terrible. The point is, how do we create a community that is addressing, you know, all of the issues that are driving people into these spaces, which are very real issues that are across the spectrum politically and identity wise, where it's like, yeah, like everyone is experiencing financial instability and just general instability. You know, climate change is driving a lot of that. There's so much to be worried about and to feel like unsettled about in the world. How can the climate movement be like a safe space and a community space for people feeling that way, as opposed to, you know, another enemy of solving that problem? So, yeah, I don't know. I feel like for a really long time that there has been a pretty like large and loud faction of the climate movement that has been very, very focused on only talking about, you know, science and technology and leaving a lot of like these other things out. And it just doesn't work. You can't build a big enough group of people that way. You know, I love battery tech. I do. It's very interesting to me, but like we're a small faction of the population, you know? So yeah. Anyway, but yeah, we need community building and solidarity to fight the fossil fuel industry, to build resilience when climate disasters come, to behave better as humans, like to, you know, be a better part of the natural world and all of those things. So
we need more battery bros, is what you're saying.
Absolutely. Yes. I welcome them.
Well, I will say those things all came through in those seasons too. I was, you know, there was a feeling of sort of like being kicked while you're down that ran through both of them. And at the end of the day, I was like, I feel surprisingly hopeful.
Good.
Having gone on these journeys.
They provide some really important context for where we're at. And I think that's like, even when you're taking in information that's like hard to hear, but it's like helpful of understanding like how we got here and illuminating these larger trends. I totally agree. It's like, oh, it's kind of hard, but it's like good hard, you know? Sometimes it's like, yeah, you need that.
For me, I'm like, I am obsessed with the idea of sort of like, everything we think is the way things work is just like one person's idea, you know, or like a handful of people's idea or a batch of decisions that some group of people made. It's whatever. It's all very like it's so much more changeable than we convince ourselves to believe. And the more people can see that, like, oh, I thought that was just a truth, but it's not a truth. It's an opinion. I think it helps people be like, now I can shift perspective, or I can maybe think about how this would look in a different way.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Well, you guys are great. It's like you do this for a living. You're making our jobs exceptionally easy. Thank you. I'm very much appreciating hearing your voices on this. If you're not already listening to Threshold and Drilled, their latest seasons, which we just discussed at length, are called Hark for Threshold and Slapped and Carbon Bros for Drilled. Amy Westervelt is actually continuing to do her thing. She's released another season in the time that it took us to publish this interview. You can find all of them wherever you find podcasts. But this conversation is far from over. We kept both Amy's on the line because we wanted to pick their brains about their approach to journalism and podcasting itself. And I'm so glad that we did, because I learned a ton from this conversation.
So if you want to sit in on our personal consultation session with these two brilliant podcasters, part two is already available on our bonus feed, which is one of the ways that we say thanks to the people who make Future Ecologies possible, all without ads or sponsors. Head to patreon.com/futureecologies to support us for as little as $1 each month. We'll see you there.